Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Strongarity seminar this week. It's a great pleasure to have Anna Aegis from NYU to give the seminar today. Anna is known for the work on bouncing universe and alternatives to inflation models. And today, I guess, she will talk about ultra locality and the robustness of slow contraction to cosmic initial conditions. So Anna, please take it away.
Thank you. And it's a great pleasure to be back. Albeit only online in Parameter. I think last time I was there, it was almost 6 years ago. So it's nice to be here. So as Juan said, I mostly prepared a strong gravity seminar, but knowing that here will be cosmologists. There will be, obviously, whenever there is something that is a more specific term or whatever, I will, a concept, I will try to make it accessible to everyone and only towards the end where I become a little more specific that hopefully everybody can bear with me. And please just put in the chat the questions. And if it's something which I guess it's easy for me, if something is absolutely important that I get answered immediately or you get answered immediately, then just raise your hand. I will try to keep track and I perhaps can ask those who want to keep track with the questions. But otherwise, it's easiest to answer them at the end. So what today's talk will be about is I would say a main result of over 2 years of work with all of these people listed, and a lot of people from whom I learned are in this audience, to most particularly Louis Lehner. So I immediately wanted to give a shout out to him since we haven't yet managed to collaborate, but a lot what I say and what I'm working on is also a result of a lot of discussions with Louis. So already thank you for that. And I look forward to your opinion and your critique, and of course, all of you. Okay, good. So just to be on the same page, since I know some of the parts of the introduction will be a little boring for cosmologists, but they should be quite interesting for strong gravity people, and we will switch very quickly so that it will be a lot of new elements for cosmologists. So the next 5 to 7 minutes will be a little bit of introduction of to lay the same ground for everyone. What I'm talking about, what I want to be talking about. Just to give away the takeaway message, and many of you I won't have to convince, what I want to show you is that it's absolutely essential, and I think it's an important new frontier to include all the tools that many of you have developed during the last few years and decades in mathematical and numerical relativity to implement it into cosmology to enhance what we have been doing the last 40 years. And I believe that we can learn a lot and things that we could not learn with the usual particle physics, effective field theory inspired perturbative approach. Why is it the case? Well, on the one hand, of course, I don't have to convince anyone that most of cosmology is in the strong gravity regime just by one of the indications of this fact is that the three curvature, for example, throughout cosmic evolution is not close to zero. So we know that we have most of the time a Hubble radius or Hubble parameter that indicates the three curvature of Friedmann-Robertson-Volkoff background that's sizable. We are nowhere close to perturbed Minkowski or perturbed Newtonian gravitational systems. So in that sense, cosmology is always strong gravity. However, we get by without non-perturbative approaches to cosmology, since the essential nonlinearity is, of course, carried in the Friedmann-Robertson-Volkoff solution. But one of the questions that are obviously not answerable in the context of perturbative cosmology is the cosmic initial conditions problem, as understood classically, namely, what type of dynamical mechanisms would lead us to a space-time as we observe today with this wonderful symmetry features of spherical symmetry and spatial flatness. And the conventional picture as one has tried to answer it really since the early 80s has been the following. And this was of course limited by the fact that we didn't have the tools. On the one hand, we didn't have the tools to handle more generic initial data, but also by quite a different philosophy than one would look at this question, how I will look at this question using the tools of mathematical and numerical relativity. So the name of the question was, and we know from observations most eminently of the cosmic microwave background, that our universe had to start in a very special stage. In the sense, special stage that over exponentially many Hubble volumes, the universe had to be by the time of nucleosynthesis, smooth and flat with a very particular imprint of fluctuations that we measure in the microwave background. And the traditional answer, really starting with Guth, was to this question to ask, well, perhaps it's reasonable to assume that there was an almost flat and smooth patch. No matter how rare, it's reasonable to assume it was there. And then the idea was, this is the conventional picture of smoothness, this rare patch having almost the right features, and we will get to that, what almost the right features is, could be, the features of this patch could be. Yeah. So the last minute was what I was trying to explain, sorry about that, the Bluetooth connection. So what I was trying to explain is that the traditional approach to the flatness and smoothness of the large scale structure of the universe during the last 14 billion years was to assume that there might have been, and of course in the approach to inflation was there might have been after some sort of quantum beginning, a patch that is well described by a geometry that's almost flat and almost smooth. This is a homogeneous line element. And here what I'm presenting here, perhaps it's familiar to many of you, it's typical how cosmologists presented to describe the early universe by using the Hamiltonian constraint of the Einstein equations as evaluated for the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker line element. So you see on the left-hand side, here in Planck units, the Hubble parameter, which also, of course, is square in Planck units, measures the total energy density. That's the energy conservation equation of Einstein gravity. And it's just defined as usual as a logarithmic time derivative of the scale factor, which is the single one dynamical parameter in this very simple metric. And then the right-hand side, one can see the different contributions to the total energy density. Here, pressureless matter, radiation, zero mode or homogeneous spatial curvature, and a certain, and we will get to that later, a very simple but rather prominent type of anisotropy that we call Kasner anisotropy. Just for the non-experts, this is the type of anisotropy, and we will talk about that a lot, so I will show you a lot more about it. Don't worry if you are not too familiar with it yet, with this type of space-time, but it's a type of anisotropy where only the diagonal elements of the spatial metric are, so we think of anisotropy, of course, always as some disturbances in the spatial metric, deviations from a perfectly diagonal homogeneous metric where all diagonal elements are the same. For example, you would think of such a metric as the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric, and a simple, elegant way of introducing anisotropy, by the way, which is also well known because it's an exact solution of the vacuum Einstein equation, is the Kasner type of anisotropy, where only the diagonal elements are affected, and you assume that different diagonal elements of the metric expand or contract at different rates. So much for this. Now, it's a simple way of introducing anisotropy, and it's also people like to introduce it this way, short of a computer or as long as there is no access to computer, because as I said, it's an exact solution, so you can do wonderful perturbative calculations around Kasner-type background. And so the idea was, without spending too much time on the conventional picture, that if there is such a line element, then if we introduce a new energy density or stress energy component, which is most commonly assumed to be, and that's where the particle physics entered cosmology in the early 80s and turned out to be a very successful marriage with questions that one could ask back then, that this new form of stress energy is by most typical sort by a canonical scalar. And we know that evaluated on a spherical symmetric background, a canonical scalar acts as a perfect fluid. Now, it's very important, only acts as a perfect fluid. The scalar field is not a fluid. This will be important very soon for several reasons. But we can characterize the scalar on the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker background in terms of fluid quantities, for example, epsilon is an equation of state, which is simply as just a rather perhaps not so common parametrization, just for those who want to know, is 3/2 times 1 plus p over rho of a given component, or 3/2 times 1 plus w. But if you add, if you evaluate it for the scalar field, where the scalar is pressure, is just the difference between its kinetic and potential energy density, while, of course, the total energy density is just sum of the two, again, no gradients because we are on a homogeneous and anisotropic background, then this little epsilon, or the equation of state parameter associated with the scalar on this special background, is just 3 times its kinetic over its total energy density. Now, we know that for certain, and as you see, so it's very important here, perhaps, for those not in the know, to see that all what changes or what influences what epsilon is a type of the potential energy density that you give the scalar. So for example, you see if it's a potential energy density, then epsilon tends to be below 3. And if it's a negative potential energy density, then epsilon tends to be above 3. Now we know that for, and we'll get to this in a second, just for this intro slide, we know that for appropriate choices of epsilon, we find that this we find stable scaling solutions for the Einstein-Friedman scalar system, and meaning that these are attractor solutions, so that space-time very quickly, starting from this nearly homogeneous and isotropic, so perhaps spatially flat in the special way, perhaps filled with matter, perhaps filled with radiation, and perhaps having Ozokaznot type and isotropy, rather quickly, one can show it converges to the stable attractor solution, which is characterized by the scale factor having this a simple scaling behavior going as a Friedman-Robertson-Walker time to the 1 over epsilon. And of course, now if you plug in simply for the Hubble parameter, the expression or the Hubble radius here, as I'm showing, the Hubble radius will go as e to the epsilon, or simply as t. Now, why is this important? Well, this is important as already good discovered that, first of all, it is good to have scaling attractor solutions because on the one hand, you want to have an extended smoothing mechanism, but it turns out that exactly the type of scalar fields and the type of epsilons that you would like to have also lead to the smoothing behavior that extends the smoothness of one patch, namely first starts to dominate all the other contributions to the energy density, and afterwards extends the smoothness on exponentially many super Hubble scales. And one of this in an expanding universe is, of course, inflation. One can, of course, see immediately just by reading off from the Friedman constraint that in an expanding universe where A grows, of course, or energy density contribution, stress energy, or geometric contribution, so the total energy density drop, but they drop at different rate as A expands. And what drops slowest is only the scalar field contribution if epsilon is smaller than 1. And of course, this is the inflationary solution. So on the one hand, it smooths the one patch, but why it smooths the one patch, the already homogeneous energy density component, what happens is you can see from the scaling behavior, the system converges to the scale, stable scaling attractor, which has epsilon less than 1. That means A is growing at an exponential rate, and H hardly does anything. The smaller epsilon, the closer it is to 0. The less H does anything. So what's happening is a smoothed Hubble patch, the features of a smoothed Hubble patch, given that there is such a Hubble patch in the early universe, can be extended over exponentially many. Now, this was the idea of inflation. And for once, if you can argue that after the quantum Big Bang, no matter how rare, it's reasonable to assume such a patch in by means of classical physics, you can extend the features of this one patch over exponentially many. And of course, any other features, such as, for example, the perturbations or quantum fluctuations on this background, will be also extended, whatever features they have on super Hubble scales. And this is also the reason why having this classical mechanism is also turns out to be the right kind of mechanism to generate nearly scale invariant. So fluctuations on the wavelength of which extends over super Hubble scales, and the amplitude of which is nearly scale invariant and nearly Gaussian. Okay, so this is the inflation story, and this is where we leave it for now. But I just wanted to show you that by classical means, as of, I would say, 2 years ago or 1 year ago, really there was no reason not to think of slow contraction as another smoothing mechanism in a way as it was introduced as a dual theory to inflation, because it really lived, in my view, from the same idea, and it really acted in terms of smoothing the universe, classically smoothing the universe by the same token as inflation. So when Steinhardt, Turok, and collaborators, many of them passed through one point of a time where I still there in perimeter, introduced this idea of slow contraction as a smoothing mechanism, they really just took the other logical possibility, or at least this is how I understand it, that the Friedman equations, the Friedman scalar equations give you. Namely, we know that that whether the universe contracts or expands when you have only homogeneous contributions, and even in more generic settings, as we will see, that's an initial condition, right? If I showed you now the dynamical equation, the Friedman equation, which is the H dot equation, that equation only knows of H dot, and the Friedman constraint, the second equation, only knows of H squared. And if I added the scalar field equation, the Klein-Gordon equation also doesn't know anything unless you give it. So it has the same form, phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus v comma v prime equals zero for an expanding or a contracting universe. So you have to give it as an initial condition, unsurprisingly, since we know that the Friedman scalar system is also a second order system. So A dot is an input, the sign of A dot is an input, and A dot tells if we expand or contract. So what they did is just said, okay, what if there was not a big bang, not a quantum beginning, but perhaps a previous stage during which the universe contracted to a certain size, can this contracting phase also smooth the universe and extend the smoothness on super Hubble scales? And obviously there is, one can read off immediately, and this is, you know, the canonical introduction to the theory of slow contraction, that just like in an expanding universe, you have to force the scalar field, the source and energy density, the macroscopic contribution to the energy density that acts as a perfect fluid in epsilon smaller than one here, because A shrinks, so all the contributions grow, but all what you need to do is have something that suppresses anisotropy. So unlike, as opposed to having a flatness problem in expanding universe, you have an anisotropy problem, and we will get to that also later. And what you do is, instead of having a small epsilon and a flat positive potential to induce it, you have a relatively steep negative potential that will trigger your equation of state greater than 3, on this homogeneous and nearly isotropic and nearly flat background. And what happens here, as opposed to keeping the Hubble volume nearly constant and expanding your physical patch, the opposite happens. And that's why slow contraction. So if you see, one can show that in a contracting universe, epsilon greater than 3 is a scaling attractor solution. It's stable, obviously it's an attractor. And A again goes as 1 upon A to the epsilon, but now for large epsilon, A goes solid. That's where the name comes, slow contraction. And what goes fast is, as you can see, the shrinkage of the Hubble radius. So it exponentially quickly shrinks in on the nearly same physical volume. And this is really just the dual picture idea to inflation. Now, what's important for the rest of the talk, and because that's where I leave the conventional picture, that both inflation and slow contraction, for the purposes of this talk, I will focus on slow contraction. There are two features that are obviously assumptions or obviously really important parts of the story. The one that you wanna, this story only works if you have, no matter how rare, such a patch that's almost flat, a flat FRW. So it might have homogeneous spatial curvature and might have Kasner type anisotropy. And the second feature is, which is also important of this picture, and some of you might have heard of it as a way of solving the causal horizon problem, that it's important for this picture that the origin of super Hubble flatness and smoothness is the same smooth Hubble patch. So in this sense, it's causal. So smoothness, the smoothing doesn't occur before the universe splits up into different Hubble volumes, but first you smooth the universe, first the scalar field, the homogeneous scalar field contribution comes to dominate the energy density. And by way of so doing, afterwards during this long phase of either inflation or slow contraction, you extend the smoothness on super Hubble scales by way of being on the scaling solution. Now, this is, we know how powerful this approach is. Many of you have worked, especially the cosmologists, on details of how inflation works. Some of you have worked on slow contraction. So one gets very far, that this, as far as to understanding lots of measurements and being able to predict features of the microwave background. However, I would say that there is a hard problem of cosmic initial conditions that this approach doesn't answer. The question that we can only answer by using all the tools that we have from relativity, both mathematical and numerical applications of it. Namely, two questions. How good of an assumption it is, at least by classical means within Einstein gravity. So all this talk will be obvious. All gravity that I'm describing is Einstein gravity and a canonical scalar, nothing beyond. And how good of an assumption this is that when the universe already is described by Einstein gravity to leading order as a whole, how good of an assumption is this nearly flat, nearly smooth initial patch? And that will be, I call the that question is, how big is the basin of attraction of the Friedmann scalar system when we start with the more complicated Einstein equations? But as it turns out, so again, I will only discuss slow contraction. As it turns out, this is actually the less interesting question. Because the second question is something that especially, and since I'm coming from cosmology, obviously I don't have to explain it to people, to you who work in strong gravity. What we tend to forget is that there are two ways strong non-linearity of gravity can enter. The one we can see when perturbation theory breaks down, but they're just one. But we also know that the Einstein equations, these guys, they constitute a coupled nonlinear partial system of partial differential equations, which is quite different than the simple ODE system that we are used and around which we perturb. So that's one way. One way that perturbation theory around the ODE breaks down. The very different ways if you choose initial conditions or when you just go away a non-perturbative, you want to ask, what happens if I'm not in the perturbative regime, if I don't start in the perturbative regime within which perturbation theory could quite long work, I can also find that nonlinearities never bring me actually to solutions. So solutions are actually never stable or very short-lived. And that's the nonlinear feature of Einstein gravity that I could never see. So I could happily do my perturbation theory around solutions, around the ODE solution, the truncated solution, and everything looks good. But I will only learn whether it's sensible, whether it's not infinitely unstable to nonlinearities of this system if I have done the calculations. And I would say for interesting enough theories, just as let's say whether it's inflation or slow contraction, it's absolutely essential to answer both questions. How big is the basin of attraction of the scaling attractor solution? And also if the scaling attractor solutions are long-lived. So whether nonlinear effects have some really interesting or disturbingly interesting effect. And as it turns out, what I want to argue today is the second question is quite surprising in the context of slow contraction. And it really turns upside down our idea of why slow contraction, the mechanism of slow contraction smooths. So this is basically, so bear with me for the next half an hour or so, because this will be interesting. At least I am very excited about it. I hope I can communicate to you my excitement. So again, for the experts from strong gravity, it hardly comes with a surprise that this is not easy. But we learn a lot from you in cosmology who have worked many, many aspects of this problem out in the binary black hole, black hole, neutron star, neutron star, neutron star merger context, or in more generic setup, usually related to compact objects. So again, just because I am aware that it's a mixed audience, why it is a 2-4 challenge And so by the first few minutes might have been a little boring for the cosmologist, let me be a little bit boring for the strong gravity audience and the more interesting, hopefully, for the cosmologist. So it is a twofold challenge for the reasons that Einstein, so it's a mathematical challenge. Because as we know from black hole physics, and as we know from the history of mathematical relativity and then computational relativity, the Einstein equations are not so easy to put on a computer, right? It's not so easy to tame them mathematically and not so easy to put them on the computer. And the reason being because the beautiful feature of Lorentz invariance of these equations, of the field equations, of course, is not so beautiful if you try to tame the equations as a PDE, as a partial differential equation system that potentially can be computed, for example, by using finite difference methods. And why is it the case? Well, because for most choices of coordinate systems and then later gauge fixing, so fixing the gauge degrees of freedom, which is a two-step process, we'll get to it. I will show you the example with which we work. The resulting partial differential equation system is something that might be, or for just arbitrary choices, is something that relativists and mathematicians call ill-posed. And ill-posed means that for many, many choices and very popular choices of formulation and gauges, we end up with a partial differential. Anyway, so what happens is that you end up with a formulation that for given initial data, the system doesn't admit a unique solution, or the solution is not continuously depending on your initial data. That's what in the mathematical literature, and that was adapted in the relativity literature, is one calls an ill-posed initial value problem. And this is what we want to avoid, both because this is not simple or practical question. Of course, if you want to have a deterministic theory, want to make prediction given some initial data, is absolute necessity. So it's not just an esoteric problem for people who want to work on a computer. This is very important to put systems into this form. Even if you work with theories that are just effective theories, at least within the regime of their validity classically, if you want to study the nonlinear structure, you absolutely have to have such a formulation for the PDE system. And the second question, of course, is, and this is why one has to work differently in the cosmological context and the black hole context, of course, you have to have an appropriate formulation for your dynamics. So for example, black hole spacetime has very different symmetries and you are interested in very different behavior often than, let's say, of spacetime that depicts our universe as slowly contracting spacetime, for example. One of the challenges will be, as you might imagine, as everybody knows who ever worked, even with just mathematical or Python coding, stiffness issues, right? Hubble volume or the Hubble scale or its covariance generalization, the mean curvature, if we do things right, should be shrinking very rapidly by physical volume. So metric elements should not be shrinking rapidly. So there should be an exponential difference in the rate, for example, of these quantities. And that has to be avoided. So we cannot just take a formulation that tracks both quantities, because if that happens, we will not be able to run the simulation for a long time. We cannot stress test the fact that what happens for 60, 100, 200 eighth words of contraction. So these are just examples that you appreciated. And those of you who are from the cosmology part and often wonder why it takes so long, why don't we just do like we do it in Mathematica, or even for often one can do it for EFTs or for data analysis. Well, this is the reason. And this is why it's a tough job, but it's very rewarding, I believe, both in the binary black hole, or binary or the compact object context, and also in cosmology. So to give you an example, and this will be a little technical, but I take advantage of the fact that I have here experts who I hope are interested in this. So those who don't, it's fine if you don't understand everything. I will give my best. But just so you get an impression, what is the formulation that we are using and why it is so well suited for the problem that we are trying to solve? So this is not a formulation we found for this problem. We take advantage of it that already the first groups that actually were working on the analytic understanding of contracting universes back in the 60s or earlier, they started somewhere out with Ernst Schücking and Jordan groups in Hamburg in Germany, and then Ehlers picked up on it, and then it propagated to different students from Caltech to South Africa to England. through George Ellis, his group, and the Caltech JPL group. So it's kind of interesting how a lot of people in the 60s, 70s worked on this formulation and trying to understand analytically contracting space times, and also motivated by this program of finding good exact solutions. And then afterwards, there were first attempt by some of the more well-known names, Beverly Berger and collaborators, and then David Garfinkel and collaborators, of course, Franz Pretorius, who tried to understand contracting vacuum spacetimes. So, and then it turns out for slow contraction is also to understand spacetime that are filled with a scalar. It's also a wonderful formalism, and I will tell you in actually a couple, in 1 or 2 minutes, why. But just to explain why is it quite a different formulation. So what one, again, obvious for relativists, not so obvious always for cosmologists, we cannot just simply do ADM. We cannot simply do the Arnovitz-Deser-Meissner formalism, so 3+1 coordinate-based foliation with algebraic gauge conditions. This is wonderful for everything in cosmology that one can do perturbatively, but exactly because of the well-posedness requirements, we know that that system doesn't give us a well-posed initial value problem. The simple reason being that due to the algebraic gauge condition, if you evaluate the causal structure of the PDE system, we find that this is only weakly hyperbolic and not strongly hyperbolic. There is no formulation of it that would be strongly hyperbolic unless you supplement it by non-algebraic gauge conditions. So BSSN formulation would be a 3+1 coordinate-based formulation. We don't work with it because it turns out that tetrads are better. For our purposes, and tetrads are a vector-based formulation. So instead of representing a space-time, every space-time point is a point-like representation, a vector-like representation. So we assign every space-time point here represented x naught to x three, four tetrad vectors, so four vectors, e naught being the time-like tetrad, and the three, the spatial triad is supplementing a naught. Or of course, the vectors are, that's why it's orthonormal, perpendicular to one another, and they are also normalized. That's why it comes from tetrad, is from the four, it's vector-based, and it's orthonormal. And it leads us to a first-order formulation of the field equations, since the dynamical quantities of this formulation are not the metric components, but first of all, since space-time locally, so it's first of all, it's a local formulation, and you have to check to what extent you can push it. Turns out that in our context, we can push it quite far, but it starts as a local formulation. It locally represents space-time through where the metric simply is here flat Minkowski metric. And the dynamical variables are, of course, the tetrad vector component, so you have to evolve them as moving from one space-time point to another. And of course, the curvature has to be described, and this is described by the Ricci rotation coefficients, which is simply a vector or tetrad generalization, one can think of it, of the connection of the Christoffel symbols. Here, for example, you can see from then that this is just a projection of the Christoffel symbol on one tetrad. And that is why our dynamical quantities are by themselves first order, and that is, so we translate the secondary metric formulation into a first order tetrad formulation of the field equations. And of course, as I said, you know, this is one way is to formulate. So we can choose both the tetrad frame. So the orientation of the time-like congruence. Now we have, that is the tetrad frame gauge freedom. We have to fix it in a clever way that we end up with a well-behaved system in the system of well-posedness. And we can also, not just can, but have to then represent the tetrad vector components in terms of coordinates, because at the end we want to have the equations that are in the tetrad formulation written as partial differential equations acting on coordinates. So that's why we have to also take a particular coordinate system that then represents the tetrad vector components. And what's nice about this formulation is, of course, all quantities act as scalars then. So you can see the Ricci rotation coefficients are scalars. So it's in some sense a very tame formulation, elegant formulation of the field equations for our context in particular. Good. And we take something which is very simple. And one of the reasons why it's a very nice formulation is it's especially if we choose what we call Fermi propagated axis, that means that we don't introduce any additional rotation. And we also take a hypersurface orthogonal tetrad, meaning that we are as close to a 3+1 formulation as you possibly can get, because all the vectors, so you have a tetrad, which is orthogonal, which is where your a naught, so the time-like congruent, time-like tetrad, is a normal vector of a space-like hypersurface. So even though you have a vector-based formulation, you very quickly can connect the quantities of this formulation, the dynamical variables, so the Ricci rotation coefficient, to physical observables, which is quite neat. And the second thing is we will use our coordinate freedom to fix the gauge in ways that is particularly well suited for a physical situation. Namely, I told you about that one of the big worries is what do you do about the potential stiffness problem that manifests itself by the Hubble, by the mean curvature, which is in the homogeneous and isotropic limit, your Hubble parameter evolving at a drastically different rate than your physical distances, again, in the homogeneous and isotropic limit represented by the scale factor. For that, we Hubble normalize the system. So the Hubble parameter, the mean curvature, is not playing a role as a dynamical quantity. And we do this by introducing the mean, and we can do it because we at the same time take a constant mean curvature slicing, ensuring that the space-like hypersurfaces at a given time have constant mean curvature. And in order that, so just not to encounter the stiffness problem, but short of a singularity resolution, which is still Einstein gravity, I haven't implemented the bands, this is just for the smoothing phase, that we don't rush into the singularity. We choose a time coordinate that tracks the mean curvature, so it takes infinite coordinate time to get to the singularity. And that's why we have a very stable evolution. We can run hundreds of EFORDs, and I'm showing you on the next slide immediately simulations, typically run 200, 150 EFORDs a simulation without encountering any stiffness problems, any singularities. This is really important because you want to check whether the smoothing mechanism is not just starting, not just robust initial data, but you want to also analyze its features. In particular, want to see how long it runs. Okay, so just before we evolve the system and I show you some simple simulations, I wanted to show again what we end up with is a little bit more beastly than the Friedmann equations, but by now it's actually a nice system. So for the dynamical variables, here are the tetrad vector components, the shear component. So this is the anisotropy component. This is the two type of spatial curvature component I told you, because we chose a Fermi propagated hypersurface orthogonal tetrad frame. It results in very nice mapping correspondence between physical quantities. So we can immediately identify the these guys as the symmetric, there's a symmetric spatial curvature or intrinsic curvature tensor. And this is this A sub A is characterizing the anti-symmetric components of the intrinsic or spatial curvature. And the shear is also a symmetric tensor, but it's again, in its full generality, not just Kästner. We can reduce it to Kästner, but it's all its six components evolve independently. And then we have here the three, the scalar field. We supplement the Einstein system with the scalar field, which is, of course, just the wave equation written in first order form. The field velocity, Hubble normalized velocity here. We will see it love. Just remember that W bar is the Hubble normalized scalar field velocity and its gradients. And this is, you probably don't see it, so just have to accept for a few experts. It's a hyperbolic set of equations, and it's supplemented by an elliptic equation. So we have a coupled elliptic hyperbolic systems, and the elliptic equation is simply the equation for our constant mean curvature gauge condition is driving the laps. And we have also, as was in the previous slide, we don't have an equation for the shift since we have a zero shift. So our box to which I will get this is co-moving with the coordinates. And hypersurface, spatial hypersurface of constant time, I constant mean curvature hypersurfaces. So, and at the same time, those hypersurfaces also, if you, as we move from one hypersurface to the other, we also measure the, it marks different mean curvatures. So it marks basically the EFORDs of contractions in terms of the Hubble radius. So it's all very neat. One has to get used to the notation, but it all has the physical meaning. So if you don't memorize that sigma is shear and A are curvature, that's okay. The important thing is what you have to, I will show you anyways, the simple simulations for it. What you have to carry is that it's a neat formulation because it connects dynamical quantities to physical observables. And of course, since we are in numerical relativity, we know we cannot just take arbitrary initial data, not just, of course, in any type of relativity, since the field equation do propagate the constraint, but that not automatically constraint satisfying. So what we need is constraint satisfying initial data. And we use the usual York method to fix parts of the metric. So what we have to do is we have to fix the spatial metric on some initial spatial hypersurface and its extrinsic curvatures. So we use what the experts know as York method. But what we care about is, so we fix these three, the tetrad vector components. And of course, this is important for this talk because we want to show a fairly generic set of initial data so that we can make fairly generic conclusion about the robustness of smoothing. So that's why it's important to take as much freedom as possibly available with as much practicality that you don't spend years on specifying your initial data. That's why we also adopt the York method. So what we freely choose is the scalar quantities, its velocity, Alfred velocity, and its Hubble normalized velocity and the field distribution. We freely choose the vacuum contribution that's allowed by the momentum constraint of the shear. So we have fairly generic shear contributions. We have a lot of handle on the shear. Of course, by freely choosing this, it fixes by way of the momentum constraint the rest of the shear. And the Hamiltonian constraint fixes the conformal factor of the conformal flat metric. Now we also check, this is just the usual trick as many of you use, for example, for Kerr black hole simulations or others, that very quickly, so our initial data is generic enough in the physics sense, of course, in no way in the mathematical sense, but in the physics sense that just within one or two time step of integration, we are very far away from conformal flatness. So if you wish, this is really just a usual device to start with constraint satisfying initial data that will then be propagated by the field equations. And what we do is really check that we excite, nevertheless, through the free choice of the other quantities, enough nonlinearities that you are quickly nonlinearly taken away from your conformal flat initial data. And a lot of talking. From now on, it will be mostly simulation. So the next 15 minutes, this was the hard part, probably, but I think it's important to give you an impression of what's going on. Now, once we solve the system, for lots of sets. So what I show you is a representative simulations of 2 years. And since we most of the time learn a lot from one or two dimensional simulation and do that simple for 3D, which will be computationally a lot more expensive and longer, we have really run hundreds of simulations. So this is a so-called two-dimensional simulations in the sense that we let inhomogeneities as initial data into two spatial directions that in this sense, two-dimensional, of course, we evolve always a 3+1 dimensional Einstein equations. And what you see here is one way what is beautiful to print and see the smoothing happening is the normalized, Hubble normalized energy density or geometric contributions to total energy density. So for cosmologists, are the capital omegas as you are used to, but these are also just really the contributions that you would usually see on the right-hand side of the Hamiltonian or Friedmann constraint for the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetime. Here, green is shear, so the Hubble normalized shear contribution, all the sigma components being in an appropriate way summarized. Red is what you call spatial curvature, but it's not just zero mode. Obviously, you can see it's huge blurb in that. It is a very inhomogeneous, very non-perturbative spatial curvature. So those capital A's and NABs here summarized as the curvature contribution from the, we read it off. If you ask me how to get it, we just read it off from the Hamiltonian constraint. There is the curvature shear and then the scalar field contribution is blue. And what you will see is, you know, the box sizes, because we have periodic boundary conditions, 2π times the initial Hubble radius. And what we expect is, of course, this will shrink. And the box will continue to represent the physical distance. It is commoving because of the coordinate gate choice. And what's happening is, you know, for the type of we ran it, you will see it in a second. We ran it with tons of initial data. So we really ran hundreds of simulations, which meaning both with a lot of different type of initial data for the same stiffness of the potential. So that's a parameter, what then source is epsilon. And also for the same epsilon, we have ran lots of initial data. So in this sense, it's a two type of initial data. We will get to that on the next slide. What was it? What turns out to be the most important initial data that makes a difference in the outcome? But what you would want to see is it's very different than what you see in binary simulations. What you want to see is that it becomes very quickly, very boring. Quickly because it will be rapid smoothing, and boring because what you see is one sheet, which is blue, that is a dominating energy density, so that has to be at one, and the other two sheets being zero because they very quickly become uninteresting. And, that's wrong. This is what I want to show you. So that what I showed you is not the simulation. This is the simulation. What I showed you next is because I went too much ahead is if you slow it down by 25 times. So it's 25, you see, you are only at one e-fold. It is not working as I wanted. So it's very little. As you can see, the time measures as e-fold of contraction of the Hubble radius. And within really almost order of one e-fold, so this is a typical simulation, you are smooth. Now, since I'm having about 10 more minutes, I want to get to the gist of this. First of all, this should be surprising, both to relativists and to cosmologists. To relativists, because what you are used to, and this is not my simulation, I borrowed this from Franz since he has a longstanding work with David Garfinkel on contracting vacuum spacetime. So what you see is a vacuum spacetime contract, and it is a one-dimensional simulation because it will tell you already. So typically, that's what one would expect. There's everything but smooth. So again, it's normalized energy densities, vacuum, so there is no scalar field. What you see is curvature and shear. It doesn't really matter which one is which, because what you see is it's a mess. So the typical outcome of contracting spacetime that are not dominated by a particle scale, namely a canonical scale with negative potential, would reproduce this mess. Now, it's not the Newtonian mess that would expect that it's a gradient-dominated collapse. That's not typical. We know that since we believe that since Valensky, Kalatnikov, and Lipschitz in the 70s, because already then, back then it was conjectured that contracting spacetime will be very quickly what one calls velocity dominated. So you remember it's a first order formalism dominated by terms that are not spatial partial derivatives. So gradient terms, that was the conjecture by Valensky, Kalatnikov, Lipschitz, would very quickly become unimportant. Now that's very counterintuitive already, because let's admit our Newtonian intuition would be contraction doesn't lead to smoothing. Well, it does lead to smoothing out of inhomogeneities, but generically, vacuum spacetime, again, generic in the physics sense, would lead to this mess, what one calls Kasner mixed master behavior. So anisotropy, a very particular anisotropy that if you simulate it is a glorious mess, really. And why we end up being a smooth and flat, that has two reasons. The first reason is this ultralocality. That is characteristics of, and that was the conjecture of BKL, and we have definitely shown it, and that's what I will tell you, and this has very dramatic consequences for the smoothing process. This is a feature of all contracting spacetimes, but we particularly have shown it for the scalar field context. So for a vacuum spacetime, I believe it has been always the what one saw in the simulations also, but for a scale with a negative potential, this is the first time that we have shown it. And this will be very interesting. So the first thing is, now what you see is it looks like, okay, it's a complicated equation. Why do I come with this? It's not important what the terms are, but you see this is the spatial curvature. I just want to show you two things. And that will be one of the last few messages of this talk, because I think this is the most exciting result. So this slide will be actually the most exciting results of the talk, I think. So just pay some attention to this. I know it's a little bit being technical, but this will be really interesting. But we cosmologists assumed always that, if you might remember of the first slide, why I introduced the way I introduced things and why do cosmologists introduce ways as they introduce inflationary spacetime, people worry about flatness problem, and anisotropy doesn't seem to be important. In contracting spacetime, people worry about anisotropies. You think that what happens is that spacetime evolves to an anisotropic but homogeneous patch, and then the epsilon greater than three eventually also comes to dominate the anisotropy. Now, this doesn't seem to be at all the case, what's happening. So that's fine, as long as you are around Kasner. If you start with any type of initial data, no matter, I will show you how close, fairly close to Kasner, that argument is just flat wrong. And it's flat wrong, one way of seeing it is seeing what the curvature does. So curvature components are, as I told you, and sub AB will be important because these are the curvature components of the symmetric intrinsic curvature tensor. And the shear are the sigmas, which are the components of the symmetric extrinsic curvature tensor. And this is symmetric is through our gauge conditions, so there are no anti-symmetric terms. And the it turns out that the anti-symmetric parts of the NAB are also just, given our gauge choice, are also not dynamical quantities. So these are the two dynamical quantities. And what you would expect is that NAB, so the curvature terms, die off much quicker than the shear terms. And of course, this won't be an analytic argument. You use numerical. So the wonderful feature of numerical relativity is, of course, that you can use the simulations even to study the feature of equations. So this is something that I particularly find appealing, because there are equations that, as a theoretical physicist, I would love to solve, but they are nonlinear, non-perturbative. I cannot solve them short of a computer. But once I solve the system with a computer, I can ask the computer how the different terms in the equation behave. For example, and this is what I did with, I want to give a shout out to my former postdoc, Andrew Sullivan, because he helped me do what we called sloppily term-by-term analysis. We took all the equations that I showed you and all the components of it, and we actually studied the equations term-by-term, wanting to identify whether these gradient terms you see here, the spatial partials, really die off quicker than the homogeneous terms. And we also wanted to see whether the anisotropic contribution that we'll go on the next slide dies off early, and the curvature contribution. And it turns out that this behaves pretty beautifully. So if you evolve the right-hand side, so you can see this is very messy. You see we start with really huge gradient contributions, and then it eventually smooths itself out. You see by around 20 e-folds of smoothing, you are done. Of course, you can also just plot the gradient terms, so these last two terms. And you might not see it, but I think you see. It evolves very differently. And now if you just take snapshot of them, so the upper part will be the four terms. I mean, these are more than four terms, of course. They are sum over terms, so the four type of terms all summed over, and just the gradient terms, the last two family of terms. Then you see it's a drastically different evolution. So the homogeneous contribution, So you start gradient dominated, but the gradients drop just as was conjectured by Belinsky, Halutnikov, and Lifshitz, and just as was fanned in vacuum space. Then also when you have a scalar field, the negative potential, this happens. Now this has some consequences. Before I explain what's happening here is, it's important that ultralocality has one consequence that you can only see from the four simulations, and that you would never have thought is possible. Well, space-time very rapidly becomes, in a certain sense, acausal. And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is that since you very rapidly, the gradients become very rapidly irrelevant, and the Hubble radius or the mean curvature, which represent the covariant generalization of the inverse Hubble radius, shrinks very rapidly. In this twofold sense, space-time points start to develop independent of one another, and well before you are smooth, you are ultra-local. Like for example, at the 10th of e-fold, you are everything but smooth, but you are in the ultra-local regime in the sense that at that point, you have e to the 10 to the 3 Hubble volumes, and points in even within and of course outside these volumes develop independently of each other. Only the homogeneous terms matter. And the consequence of this is that whenever you start to smooth, that doesn't have the same Hubble origin. The reason for smoothing is twofold. It's the one case is the ultralocality, the gradients die off. But of course, you want to have the other terms die off. So what happens is, it's beautifully seen on this. It was invented by relativists who studied vacuum space-time. So you see this so-called phase for the particular parametrization of the sigmas of the shear, and you represent different points of space-time evolving. And on the color coding is representing by what e-fold, where they are at what e-fold of contraction. And so in vacuum space-time, the circle would be the pure Kasner space-time, and the middle of the circle is the flat Friedmann, Robertson, Walker. And ultralocality has the consequence that because very quickly only the homogeneous terms matter, every single point independent of one another is following the same homogeneous equations of motion, exploring different histories, but they all end up at the middle for most initial data and for most equation of state. And this is the second part of the study. As a matter of fact, before I get to that, I just wrap up in the next 3 to 5 minutes quickly. You can, of course, study different simulations. That was the whole point. But turned out in our case that the most important observable that made a difference was the velocity. So for example, here we compare two simulations where the red patches know that those parts of space-time has uphill-directed velocity. So it's like crazy, right? The scalar field is moving uphill negative potential. And the blue is the downhill moving velocity. And then you run the simulation and compare different points. You do what I call, and that's why we call term-by-term analysis. I showed you a movie of that, but of course we did lots of plot of them. And I just want to, you know, assert it short of time, but you know, you compare the different plots, different initial data, different simulations with the same potential and different points. Obviously, even though they experience, starting from different initial data, they experience different histories, they end up in the same state. So for the overwhelming majority of the initial conditions, and what the overwhelming majority means is a lot, I wish it's really almost all phase space of initial data. So short of, really probably not in the mathematician's language, but for physics pedestrian languages, except for a very well-defined, perhaps measure zero set of initial data, you smooth. And why is this the case in space-time where you added a scalar field with a negative potential as opposed to any other space-times, empty space-time, space-times with matter, space-times filled with radiation, space-times filled with a free scalar with positive potential? Well, that now you can show analytically. So no worries, I don't move you to the comment, but wonderful thing about numerical relativity is that it gives you all the solutions, all the intuitions that you would be impossible, I would be unable to find just by pencil and paper. But then you will really appreciate these solutions when you go back to the drawing board and the limit of your solution, actually, you can do some neat mathematics. And what we have shown is that we use really our numerical experiments to establish to the extent possible ultralocality. And then in the ultralocal limit, we
Anna, we lost you again.
Yeah.
I know, it's bad. So in the ultralocal limit, we have proven, and okay, I don't have time for it, but it's a really neat proof that the ultralocal system of differential equations, first of all, has only two stable fixed points. And now you can ask, again, going back to relativity, and one of the stable fixed points is Kasner. That's what I showed you, this massive space-time. And the other one is flat FRW. And now you remember my first question. What is the basin of attraction of each fixed point? Now, again, you can ask it with numerical relativity. Now, you know you only have to, space-time has no other choices. It either goes to Kasner, or once you establish ultralocality, since the evolution is fundamentally ultralocal, it either goes to Kasner or to FRW. Now you want to go and see what is the set of initial data for FRW. And what we have found is running lots of simulations. First of all, we found, as I mentioned, that the main parameters, so all these points correspond to an array of initial data. So for all these points, we set different shear, different, the curvature is of course conformally fed, but different shear contributions and different velocity distributions. And what happens, we add in a lot different modes. So it's not just a zero mode, but different Fourier modes for the initial data. Of course, you have to imagine the initial data as sinusoidal because of the periodic boundary data. And we also study all the initial data for different potentials characterized here by the epsilon. And what you see is almost all of, for all initial data. And of course, really, the typical initial data is somewhere here. I just haven't shown that to you. And I will wrap up in 2 minutes, so I see that I'm almost out of time. And that's what we mean by large basin of attraction. For almost all initial data, you end up smoothing. And with Kasner, and this is a Kasner space time. So with Kasner, so it's homogeneous but anisotropic, and we poke it. So one way of seeing what is the basin of attraction of it is you go as close as possible to it, and then you see how much you have to poke it that you go away. So for FRW, you could go very far away, non-perturbably far away, you still get that. For Kasner, what happens is, and this is an example for it, what we have found is that actually it's so, the basin of attraction of it is so small, as we find a numerical experiment that look at this poking, you don't even see it. It is a tiny off-diagonal element. We poke it, and eventually destabilizes and goes over to FRW. course, Hungary fought, but this is what is demonstration of one neat demonstration of the fact that Kästner has a, as far as we can see, it's a numerical evidence, a small basin of attraction. So just to wrap up, I told you I would be done. The three main takeaway lessons, I think, for contracting spacetime. So slow contraction in the classical sense. So starting off with the universe, which is low energy, but really your geometry and your scalar field distribution can be wild in the non-perturbative regime of flat FRW. And what you end up is for a huge set of initial data, you end up in flat FRW very rapidly. Second, which is I find, so this is the robustness and rapidity. But the second thing, where I find a second fact, which is more interesting, and this is truly coming from the nonlinear analysis, that so apart from not needing a select special set of initial data, this idea that you first have to, that smoothness must have a causal origin, that you first smooth and then put the smoothness on super Hubble wavelengths. This is just doesn't seem to be at all the case. So you don't first smooth and then become super Hubble on exponentially many Hubble volume. But what really happens is you first become very quickly ultra-local. And because of the ultra-local system, once you have this canonical scale with a negative potential, has really a single fixed point with a huge basin of attraction, which is a flat FRW, you get that. And what I swallowed over is, because I like to keep it to the end, what microscopic eyes might have seen, and one would have to play it back, what's really essential is that the curvature doesn't die off before the anisotropy dies off. As a matter of fact, spatial curvature plays a role in destabilizing any space-time state, ultra-local state. So this non-gradient or homogeneous, so-called in the sense velocity term type spatial curvature is essential in taking you away from any solution that is not flat FRW. So one can compare under simulation and see what's happening is that you really need, and this is something that one perhaps could have thought of, but of course after the fact it's easy by knowing that even in the vacuum spacetime, it's spatial curvature that put you from the von Kästner circle point to another. So you don't go, as Turok and Steinhardt and their collaborators conjectured, from something messy to Kästner then to FRW. That's not what's happening. You go from something messy to a curved anisotropic ultra-local state, and spatial curvature is your friend in helping you, getting you to the flat FRW fixed point. So it's a very different picture than one would have thought from pencil and paper perturbative analysis. And how different it is, and it has a lot of, we already started with that, but of course, because it's so powerful, we are in the middle of extending a lot of these features to the perturbations, to, of course, we want to see it. It's actually something that Luis suggested last time when we were at a meeting in person in Sesto, to extend these results to black hole physics with a negative scalar. Of course, ultimately, you want to build cosmologies and you want to have a balance in that, but this is a lot more difficult. That there we have to have something that is not just quite as pretty as Einstein gravity. So this is for the future and for future talks. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Anna, for the very nice talk. Any questions? Yeah, please.
Hi, Anna. A few questions. First, let me get this straight. So, because at some point I thought all the trajectories end up in the smooth out, but then you mentioned there are two fixed points. I got a little bit confused.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Just let me. So I might have run over that a little too quickly. So there are two fixed points. So what you do is you take the ultra-local system and then you identify all the possible fixed points. And for a negative potential, so this would be a fixed point that require at least a positive potential. So it's nice because you can do it more generically. And either the fixed point turns out to be where your potential. So if you don't have a negative exponential, the potential very quickly has to give to the scalar field kinetic energy. So it behaves like the Hubble normalized potential doesn't contribute. And that will eventually source a Kästner spacetime just as vacuum would source a Kästner spacetime. And the other fixed point is the flat FRW. And so it's not the case that it's impossible to find initial data that eventually doesn't go to FRW. So there is a small set of initial data, and the small is the key that goes to Kasner. But what you can do with numerical experiments that you ask, what set of initial data goes to which fixed point? And what we have found is that and I can tell you what set of initial data goes to Kasner, what it takes. It takes a huge uphill kick to the velocity. So what anything else, but only if you have, which is classically probably questionable, and especially if come from a cyclic evolution, but if for some reason a classical scalar would have an average velocity, and this is one what we have, so when all the fields, so just let me go back there, here. So all the fields, so this would be a space-time where almost all the velocities go uphill, and here almost all the velocities go downhill. So you have a lot of red patches, they go uphill. If all space-time would go uphill, and we have a very shallow exponential potential, those are the situations when we could end up Kasner, because they're the, and this is where it shows, by the way, beautiful, the scalar is not a fluid, that a scalar would not have a chance to behave as a fluid with an equation of state corresponding to epsilon, corresponding to Stefanopoulos potential, it would behave as a free field. So those are the set of initial data, and it's a small set of initial, we would say it's a small set of initial data because you can have arbitrary large geometric fluctuations, it still goes down. It really needs this huge uphill kick for the scalar velocity kick. So velocity has to be uphill directed. That goes to Kasner.
Okay, and it takes me a little bit also to the initial condition. So that's is that in terms of that parameter Q that you're mentioning?
Yeah, exactly. Sharing is suboptimal to go back and forth. Sorry, I think it's here.
So is there a way?
The lower limit. So you know, you always know when if your simulation works, when you can show when it doesn't give you the result that you want. I mean, we wanted to find the region where it doesn't smooth. And you see this is very shallow potential, so corresponding to epsilon of 5. I didn't mention it, but the relationship between epsilon and the steepness of the potential. So if we model the potential as, and for that I have actually a slide, just let me unshare it, because it will be easier. Show very quickly that. Okay, here it is. Sorry. Okay, so if you have a negative exponential, and in the meantime, we have also both in the paper, and I'm coming out with a paper to study more generic formula of the potential. But if you, the steepness is of course characterized by the inverse mass scale, which is just a characteristic mass scale of the potential. You see that, or the tiny mass scale corresponds to epsilon 50 or 5,000. These are huge. But I have shown you the epsilons, putting into context. So typical epsilons are somewhere out here. Tiny epsilons, which are not, so we have to find an epsilon where the potential is too shallow to smooth, or the velocity is too small. And what we have found, of course, if I had shown you negative velocities, then of course you would have had, depending on how shallow the potential is, that the region of unsmoothed region is the smoother that we just stated, that is the borderline, which we consider classically almost impossible that you keep going uphill with a large velocity. But that was the, and just let me just reiterate that, of course, Q naught is just the initial data for the velocity. All of these points in this phase but corresponds to lots of different initial shear and scalar field distributions.
Okay, and I guess one last thing, when you have this feature, that was that the trend that always go up to ultra local, that's what you call
is that
a scale or a variance that you can quantify that?
Oh, that's a great point. So we actually did it, and this is quite universal. So in these time coordinate is parallel in the Friedman-Roberts of Walker time, it would be an exponential follow. So that you have great eyes. So that is exactly the point, that independent of the initial data that falls off at the same rate. And we have a little calculation in the paper to show if you take, we cannot show anything. So the nonlinear part is I cannot compute it. That's difficult. That's fine. But once it's ultra-local, you can see that this term, also by the term-by-term analysis, becomes dominant. And then if you just solve for it, you can see that the log behavior from the first, just solving these equations and is at nearly constant, and you can reconstruct at least by the ultra-local limit, the fall off is universal and is depending on your time coordinate exponential parallel. What is more interesting, and this is only the numerical evidence that we have for it, that even the gradient terms seem to be falling off following a similar behavior once they are out of the messy state. But we cannot reconstruct that from the terms are just too difficult. This is fully nonlinear. So first the gradient fall off, and then afterwards the curvature and anisotropic terms fall off exponentially in the orthologous limit. Yeah.
So I guess my point was, is there like a time scale? I can read up what parameter dictates the time scale, but it's not easy to read.
But the time scale is actually relatively irrelevant because it depends on when it reaches the ultralock. It depends on initial data. So, but we have found that it's generically very quick. So it's within 5 to 10 efforts for even very messy initial data, you are smooth. So ultralocality settles in around 5 efforts of contraction of the mean curvature. Or Hubble in the homogeneous limit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And again, sure. Very nice stuff.
Thank you. Vil has a question, I think, at least.
Thanks, Anna, for the next talk. Mm-hmm. So I guess you were saying that all these results were for one or two dimensions. So I was wondering if you have started looking at three dimensions or have any thoughts about how that might change things. Because, I mean, in particular, I guess you're assuming this translational symmetry, so that'll kind of make gravitational attraction a bit weaker. And so have you thought about what happens for kind of gravitationally bound objects? I guess the extreme example of that would be like a black hole. What would happen near that?
Good. So we did run a few. So what we did is, I can tell a little bit, really takes 30 seconds. They started with 1D. Of course, Bill is an expert, so it requires an expert answer. And I know that you are particularly familiar also with the inflation part. But what we did is we ran first in 1D, then we went up to 2D, then we ran a similar amount of simulation and did a few simple simulations if you see something different in 3D. So what we learned from 1D, that's actually easier to... So there are two parts of it. We haven't studied particular, the one thing what we have not done, and we don't know if we can even do it. There is one case that you can only do, of course, and I appreciate, I think that the parts of the reason probably why you ask is if we can see what it would take for a black hole to form before something settles, at least in some parts of space-time. So anything else, of course, we could do, but we found it in 1D. So in 2D, if you go up and add a lot more modes and more poking to Kasner are possible, more poking of space-time. So that actually it was easier to smooth. That is our second, that is a paper from last March. It's actually almost a year ago already. Then we have shown that actually going up to 2D makes smoothing easier, adding up a lot more modes in to the dimensions. So that's what we have so far. And then we did a few simple simulations in 3D, but we didn't particularly look at spherical perturbation that would lead to black hole formation. So that's the one that we didn't do, but we didn't find that the 3D result would differ from the others. Now, what you're asking is what it would take for a contracting space-time, what spherical initial fluctuations so that it closes before you get to the black hole space, and we haven't done that. I mean, I guess that it would be quite, we actually have been chatting with Franz, you know, especially is in this context of spherical perturbation. I think one could, this is definitely a great project to do, to figure what it takes for space-time, how big the initial perturbation should be and what shape it should have, which has to be, I guess, spherical or close to spherical to form a black hole before which locality settles. So we haven't yet done it, but we talked about it. But other than that, so if you don't have those perturbations, if you have more, you know, asymmetric perturbation, the few 3D simulations that we did confirm what we saw with 2D, that it's even easier to smooth than more difficult because you have more degrees of freedom that can be excited that would, you know, that take you away from what would be the Kasner basin of attraction. And what, again, just let me assert what I already, to Gazelle, I said that it was the uphill directed velocity. So that was the important part again. But I think it's an important, an interesting question to ask. What would it take to form black holes? Yeah.
Yeah, maybe as a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. So since you have negative potential energy, mm-hmm. you're actually kind of in something analogous to ADS.
Yeah.
So, I mean, technically, it seems like maybe it'd be possible to form a black string. So have something that has a translational mm-hmm. symmetry, but would still have an horizon.
That's a good question. I mean, I haven't thought about it. I must say, I would just take up your time to. No, we haven't. Actually, we were just starting to discuss what kind of defects we can get. The main issue that I pressure is that I just had a student who is finishing up the paper, master's student, who studied potentials which are bounded from below. and both again 1D, 2D, and the same a few samples in 3D, just so that we can complete the stage and end up, you know, in out of slow contraction. We didn't find there anything, but we haven't studied what are the, you know, typical conditions both for black hole, but typical. What would it take to form black holes? What would it take to form more interesting? That those are all open questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Any other questions?
Yes, I have one. Thank you, Anna. So in your talk, so you identify regions of the initial data part, whatever configuration, mm-hmm. that give you different type of behavior afterwards. So how am I to understand how nature will pick? I mean, you're in your picture, you're going through the bounds, it will just somehow, I mean, take the right one, or are you going to think that there is going to be pockets of universe with different characteristics? So what's your overall picture now?
So the overall picture is the following. You know, we wanted to ask, you know, for what is the set of initial data, you know, for which you would get a flat and smooth space-time. So, and what we found is that it's a very broad set of initial data. So if you have a single band scenario where had, you know, what type of, the real question was, you know, originally the idea of cosmologists was you need one rather special patch, but once you have that, that will generate you the type of universe that you care about and the rest is not important. And now if you take a completely random distributions of geometries, what we find as soon as you have a scalar, if the universe is it doesn't even have to dominate. If there is a scalar field that has a negative potential, then for most initial configurations, short of those where the field goes uphill, you will get the right kind of patch, and that will be the typical outcome. Now, if, you know, we can discuss it, you know, is it the right measure, take the most initial data or so. I would say that in this single bounds picture, my picture is this, that you have a lot of freedom. Nature has a lot of freedom to start this scenario. Will it for sure start it? No, I cannot say. But then there is a second scenario that I'm more interested in, and we are actually doing now, again, still, you know, one mode of operation is not to implement the bands, which is, as you know better than I, it's very difficult because of the modification of gravity. But there is another question what one can ask is, what if the universe is cyclic? What if it's not a one-time bounce, but let's say our current dark energy phase will eventually, you know, it's a quintessence type dark energy, so the cosmological constant with a negative through vacuum energy. What type of patch can be today that will eventually lead to a slow contraction? And then it's reasonable. One thing is reasonable to assume that the field is rolling downhill. So in that scenario, actually, one can, of course, this formalism is bad for it because the Hubble will go to zero. So we cannot take Hubble normalized variables. So we have to, a different type of simulation. But in that picture, so if the universe is cyclic and not one-time bounds going to lambda CDM universe, which dies off in a heat death, then it's reasonable to assume that the dark energy is rolling down here. So that for most, no matter how small, unless those patches that end up as black holes and close, you will go to a smoothing contraction phase. So I think it's a different outlook for the cyclic case versus, I don't know what nature would take, but I think nature has a high likelihood to encounter the patches, which are lots of them that don't end up Kasner, but go to slow contraction. And then, of course, we have to still show that the balance is robust. That's a different story. But I would say that, you know, I think nature has a lot of options to choose, but it gives the right answer, and only a few options, but it leads to Kasner.
Okay, so we're back over time. Maybe one last question, Niyash?
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Anna, for the very nice talk. So just two quick questions. So you didn't actually try to do the bounce with the, I mean, you just...
Well, not in this project. So what we are doing is I have done analytics work on it. It's very difficult. I mean, the difference is, and, you know, Luis is really the expert. I think that he has done most work on this to point out how difficult it is to implement anything in numerical relativity or just mathematically get under control something that's not Einstein gravity. And so I have done analytic work to this, and actually we are, you know, that was a precondition. So you cannot bounce if you don't smooth. If you just start with an arbitrary space-time and turn a modification of Einstein gravity, I think that's going to be an arbitrary mess. And you don't even have a control probably whether it's your imposedness or whatever. So and it, the main work that it requires is really I'm just repeating really what Luis usually says, trying to figure if one can tame things at least around certain backgrounds and under what conditions one can do it. And we don't know of any theory beyond Einstein except for Bronsticky. The conformally coupled Einstein gravity that's well posited, that has a, you know, well posited formulation for, in a proper sense, at least locally well posited for arbitrary backgrounds, that's well posited. So that is the problem, but we are working on it. I'm just saying that I wanted to explain why it's so much more difficult. Yeah.
Very good. So, quick question, a follow-up to that. So you are using this CMC foliation for your simulations?
Yeah, and that you cannot use for balances, yeah. So that you, of course, cannot, because the constant mean curvature changes monotony behavior. So your space-like hypersurface around the bands would become time-like. So that's why even just going from expansion to contraction, which is Einstein gravity, we need a different formulation, because H just goes through zero. So the mean curvature would go to zero.
I think this is a very good point, but I just wanted to maybe suggest that you look at this thing Ghazal has worked on. She calls it Kaskuten bounds, because it's actually perfect. The CMC foliation is a perfect foliation to actually do it in, because in fact Kaskuten is homogeneous in CMC foliation all the time, but it can violate nonlinear condition without any instability. So I think there's an opportunity to actually study bounces. And I know CMC foliation is tricky, but I think there's a way to get around that, but maybe that's something we could discuss.
I'm saying that we cannot Hubble normalize it. In our case, probably should add it, because there are, as for the expert, it's actually important for us to have a well-posited formulation, how we Hubble normalize too. So there are certain formulations, even for autonomous tetras, that are not well-posited. So we would have to, I think David Garfinkel has a different with Karsten Gundlach, where it's not Hubble normalized, but that's parabolic, the picture. So what I'm saying is I haven't looked into that because I was interested in other type of bands, but thanks for the point. I will definitely look at it.
Thanks.
Okay, as I said, we're a bit over time, so let me just stop recording.